Welcome back to Making Waves. We now bring you Palestine Reports, report from the West Bank, from the town of Bilin, on the history and current struggle of the people of this village, including content from the demonstration Friday, May 12th.
The problem with the settlement and the war on Bilin started in the early 80s. Some land was confiscated to build the settlement of Metatiyahu. Then in 1993, they confiscated another part of the land and built the settlement of Kiryat Sefer. And then in 2000, Israeli confiscated an additional piece of land to build a new settlement next to Mudin Elite settlement, which they called Eastern Metatiyahu. The settlement consumes a wide area of land. Most of it will be annexed to Israel by the wall. It is almost 2,300 dunams or 575 acres of land. Civil resistance started in Bilin after the start of the construction of the separation wall and after we knew about the plans to build this settlement, because only at that time plans about the settlement were revealed. The first demonstration in Bilin started on the 16th of December 2004, and then we stopped for 1 month after the construction stopped for 1 month. And we did another one and stopped as the work stopped. But since February 20th, 2005, actions were organized every week and are still going on.
Yeah.
It's so difficult.
This is the demonstration before the court, before our court in the high court in Jerusalem about the wall. On Sunday, the court want to speak about, to take a decision about the wall that's built in Bilin land. And we invited many people, international Israelis, volunteers, and Palestinian in this demonstration. And we raised Palestinian flag to tell the Palestinian we have a big problem with the soldiers, and we have a big flag. This is a Palestinian flag, not green or white or black. We want one flag, and we want to tell the Palestinian to stop the fighting between Gathers, Fatah, and Hamas, and to go to the demonstrate against the occupation, to stop the occupation in Palestine land. And we do this in, today in, after praying, after Juma praying. When we arrived, the soldiers closed the gate by the fence, and we want to enter. They stopped us, and some of the youngs throwing stones to the soldiers, and the soldiers began shooting rubber bullet and gas, tear gas. And it's not far. All of the people who's injured near the soldiers, they don't throw stones. One of the injured is journalist, and their hands is broken their fingers, and now he's in Sheikh Zayed Hospital in Ramallah. And we have another two youngs from the internationals. They entered the Tel Shomer Hospital, and the two youngs in a difficult situation now. And all of the who's injured, around 12 people today injured in our demonstration.
Of the 12 people injured in this demonstration, one sustained life-threatening injuries. Phil Reese from Australia was shot in the head by a rubber-coated steel bullet, which resulted in a brain hemorrhage. He had been filming the demonstration. B.J. Lund from Denmark was also shot in the head and suffered a fracture in his jaw. Both are currently recovering. But the people of Berlin are not strangers to this sort of violence. I asked Abdullah Aburrahme of the Popular Committee Against the Wall in Berlin if this demonstration was unique in that it resulted in the injury of demonstrators.
So, yani, every demo we have some people injured. But all of the people from the beginning until now, around 500 youngs injured from Palestine, and we have around 100 from Israel and international who's injured.
The people of Berlin have been demonstrating every Friday for the last 15 months, confronting the wall and the army that stand between them and their land. But the resistance here in Berlin has taken on many different forms. In December 2005, the people of Berlin decided to do something never before done in the struggle against the annexation of Palestinian land. The Popular Committee Against the Wall in Berlin decided that in order to oppose directly the continued construction of this settlement, they must occupy their land. Abdullah Aburrahme described what happened.
We have a road, but we want to take to be closer to the room, not to take the road. Yeah. This outpost we began, we know that illegal houses built without permission from the government. And when we know this information, we come and we take a decision to put a caravan in this area. Where are we going now? To put a caravan there. And we put the first caravan in 21 of December, and in another we put ourselves in this caravan and closed this caravan, me and my friends, internationals, Israelis, volunteers. And in the second day they gave a big machine and take the caravan and beat us very badly. And when we return to the village, we thinking about another idea. We take a decision to put another caravan. We put another caravan in 25 of December, after 4 days after the first caravan. And they back the soldiers and tell us, why you are putting another caravan? We want to take it tomorrow, because now it's later in the evening and the office is closed to take permission to take this caravan. But in the morning we return and take this caravan. And we making dialogue between us and between them. Why you are didn't take this home from our land? It's illegal homes. They say we know this, but we have steps to take it, to destroy it by the court. We tell him, if we have a home like this, you can do the same thing. They say, yeah, if you have a home with windows and with doors, with ceiling, it's okay, not like the caravan. Okay, we say, okay, yalla, bye bye. They left us, and we thinking in the night to build a small home. In the night at nine, it's rain and cold. We take this decision and we begin to build this small home. And it's closed, the gate is closed, and the soldiers here. It's very, very difficult to give the material and to build, because the soldiers, if they see us, they stop us. We can come from here. We take a decision, and we many people around 50 persons from Israel, from international ISM, and from my village. We give the material by hands, and we began to build it at 9. It's rain, cold. We put a fire in the middle of this room to be dry, to dry quickly. And at 2 o'clock, after 5 hours, we finished this room, and we put the ceiling in our hand, the ceiling, until 6 o'clock morning, and we put the ceiling on the room. And the soldiers coming at 7. When they say the room is built and ready, it's very anxious and it's very nervous. Asking many questions. And they take a photos for the room. And they take the caravan, the second caravan. And they tell us, you make a permission for this room, and you have 2 weeks to do this permission. After 2 weeks, we go to the Beit Il to do this. We saw the employer have a holiday, 2 weeks, another 2 weeks for this employer, and they say to us, return after another 2 weeks. We have, come here, we have now 2 months, 1 month. And until now we making the permission and the steps for permission, and until now we have this room. It's here, and 20 hours we are here, Palestinian flag on it, and sleep in this room, and coming day and night. And the court tell the soldiers to be able open the gate, that's the gate near the wall, to enter to our room.
This small one-room house built on the Israeli side of the wall is still standing today, as its demolition is tied up in the courts. The reason for this is that the Mudin elite settlement, which is illegal under international law, may very well be illegal under Israeli law as well, due to the absence of any permits whatsoever to build. If this were to be the finding of the Israeli High Court, it would be the settlement and the wall that was demolished, and not Bilin's one-room house. Michael Sfaudi, the Israeli lawyer representing Bilin in court, explains.
Within the three, there is no case that contends that the settlements are illegal. We argue that construction of the neighborhood is illegal according to planning and construction law, not according to international law. Basically, we have three different court cases now. One dealing with a fence, one dealing with an neighborhood that is being was built on Bilin's land for the settlement, and the third one we've just filed that deals with the ownership of the land, trying to cancel retroactively the expropriation of the land. These are the three cases. They are intermingled and interrelated. And at the moment, all of them are pending. There was a hearing, a very long one, a very tedious one, a very difficult one. We're still waiting for a decision. The option that was raised during that hearing was that the court, that the hearing was in the framework of the petition regarding the fence. And the option that was raised is that the case will remain pending until a final decision will be rendered in the other two cases, because if the neighborhood will be canceled, then of course it has ramifications on the legality of the route of the fence. If the neighborhood will be koshered and built, then it also has consequences and ramifications on the correct or the legal route.
There has never been a case in the Israeli High Court that has successfully challenged a settlement under Israeli law, according to Michael Sfaudi. But these legal challenges are only one avenue through which the people of Bilin have taken their struggle, and it will surely continue regardless of what the Israeli High Court rules. Reporting from Occupied Palestine with the IMEMC, I'm Seth Porcello.
They're building a wall between friends, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before. Many feet thick and 20 feet high, no one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep distant the chambers of gas from the bulldozer's gunships and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and all honor defiled, to remove reality from your facts on the ground. Distant, the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie.
at such a cost. Land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people upon their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
That was David Rovics with "They're Building a Wall." You're listening to Making Waves. Now for Jav Parrish with "Now We Care."
Now We Care. This is Jav Parrish. In October 2001, the United Nations warned that up to 7.5 million people were at risk of dying from starvation during Afghanistan's coming months, at precisely the time that the United States launched a post-9/11 war to displace the ruling Taliban. As the snows of late November approached, and with them a guaranteed death sentence for millions living in areas made impassable to aid trucks by winter snows, Washington refused to halt its bombing runs and Northern Alliance proxy war long enough for aid to resume. It was only through the serendipitous decision of the Taliban to withdraw to the mountains before winter's onset that mass famine, in effect a genocidal invasion, was averted. Virtually nobody in America noticed the narrowly avoided Holocaust. In October 2004, the British medical journal Lancet published a peer-reviewed article that made a compelling case that to date, the U.S. invasion of Iraq had caused some 100,000 deaths over and above the civilian mortality that Iraq would have experienced in peacetime. Given that more time has passed since then, and that civil war has begun on top of it, that number undoubtedly now exceeds 200,000 Iraqi deaths. The number continues to climb daily. You can find the details each day, a few of them, in small type, on page 827. And now, America erupts because the Bush administration has been secretly building a database of every single phone call in the country, and it probably already includes your calls. Why was anyone shocked? A Boston Globe story nearly 5 months ago reported that the NSA was not simply monitoring the international phone calls of Americans, as the White House claimed, but using data mining operations to survey millions of Americans' calls. The revelation that the NSA is not only doing data mining, but building a permanent database from call records is only one more step. Appalling? You bet. A surprise? Only if your head has been buried in the sand. But civil liberties, now being lost, can eventually be restored. The lives of the nearly 3,000 people who died when Bush ignored warnings about 9/11 cannot be restored. They aren't coming back. Neither are over 2,400 American soldiers. Neither are all those people who drowned during and after Katrina, many of whom are still missing and whose bodies will never be found. But even the cost of the Bush cabal in American lives is a drop in the bucket compared to what they're willing to spill in other people's bloods, societies whose members, it ought to go without saying, but can't, value life just as much as you or I. The lives of over 200,000 Iraqis lost in a war launched illegally and sold by lies can never be restored. Millions of Afghans narrowly avoided the same fate. And now, these zealots are seriously considering nuking Iran, an action which would not only directly result in untold additional numbers of deaths, but which would spark a conflagration that would make Iraq's dead look like loners. So why do we care about someone knowing who we called, but not about the obliteration of whole cities or countries? Don't we need a little, like, perspective here? Aren't we talking not just about criminal actions and civil liberties violations here, but war crimes? And if Saddam Hussein is on trial for crimes against humanity, why isn't George W. Bush? From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Christopher Pyle, a former intelligence officer and professor of constitutional law, who examines the latest revelations concerning data collection and surveillance of U.S. citizens. Stan Goff, retired Special Forces Master Sergeant and peace activist, who explains why he believes the U.S. has already lost the Iraq War. And Mary Beth Powers of Save the Children, who describes the millions of preventable infant deaths in poor nations around the world and the simple, affordable steps that can be taken to save lives. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report by the British charity Christian Aid projects that 185 million people in sub-Saharan Africa may die from the effects of global warming by the end of the 21st century. The anti-poverty group says millions more Africans will be hurt by floods, famine, and drought brought on by climate change. The report, The Climate of Poverty, Facts, Fears, and Hopes, states poor people will bear the brunt of global warming, so we are calling on rich countries to help them adjust as the seas rise, the deserts expand, and floods and hurricanes become more frequent and intense. John Houghton, the former co-chair of the scientific assessment body of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, endorsed the report. The Kyoto Protocol on Climate Change requires wealthy nations to reduce their level of greenhouse gases to 5.2% below 1990 levels by 2012. The U.S. has refused to sign on to these binding emissions reductions, and the rapidly industrializing economies of China and India are exempt. Christian Aid is calling for more radical reductions of carbon emissions, slashing greenhouse gases by two-thirds by 2050, and requiring China, India, and Brazil to sign the climate change regimes. The report also calls on the United Nations to add carbon emissions reduction targets to the Millennium Development Goals, designed by the UN to cut the worldwide level of extreme poverty in half by 2015. The Interpress Service reports civil society activists in Islamic Iran are fearful of accepting money from the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy. Activists point to the recent arrest of Iranian scholar Ramin Jahanbegloo by security agents at the Tehran airport. He was arrested for working for the NED. In its offensive against Iran, the Bush administration has set aside $75 million to promote civil society in the Islamic nation, funding dissident broadcasts into Iran and paying for scholarships and fellowships. The arrest of Jahanbegloo also signals a new hardline attitude by the Islamic government against non-governmental organizations who receive funds from the United States or Europe. The regime of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad views NGOs as tools of Western interest in fostering nonviolent regime change. Conservative officials cite U.S. involvement in the civil revolts in Georgia and the Ukraine. Over the last few months, Iran's Interior Ministry has questioned dozens of NGOs about their activities and funding. They were also told to report any contact with foreign organizations. Some Iranian civil society activists believe that the U.S. policy of funding opponents of the fundamentalist regime will intensify a government crackdown on NGO activities. 3 years ago, Roger Anstett, who served 12 years of a 20-year sentence in Oregon prisons, died unnecessarily from a hepatitis C infection. Despite his symptoms, extreme fatigue, achy joints, and abdominal pain around his kidneys, it took 2 years for doctors to order the blood test required to diagnose the disease. It took prison officials another year to begin treatment, and by that time, Anstett's liver was too damaged for drugs to be effective. Just days before his death, Anstett recorded a deposition in a lawsuit against the Oregon prison system over his being denied treatment for hepatitis C. In 2005, the state settled out of court in a historic agreement to open up its treatment program to hepatitis C patients. According to the Progressive magazine, over 3 million people now suffer from chronic hepatitis C infections, triple the number of HIV/AIDS cases. According to a 2003 report by Scott Allen, Rhode Island's Corrections Department medical director, hepatitis C is the leading cause of death in several state prison systems. Hepatitis C was only discovered in 1989 and is commonly contracted in prison through sexual activity, tattooing, and drug use. Unlike AIDS, hepatitis C, if caught early enough, is completely treatable, but can be costly. Since the high-profile Oregon settlement, the state has begun treating over 1,000 inmates. However, families of deceased inmates have recently filed wrongful death suits against the prison system. In response to the settlement, prison advocates in New York State and New Jersey have also filed lawsuits over hepatitis C treatment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino. Thank you.
press reports that the National Security Agency has secretly collected call records of tens of millions of phone company customers since September 11th, added to the controversy over President Bush's December admission that he ordered warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens' international phone and email communications. USA Today reported that despite the government's failure to obtain a court order, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South handed over the phone records of their customers while Quest refused. The White House maintains their monitoring program is aimed at preventing terrorism and is legal. This new controversy could interfere with the White House plan to install General Michael Hayden as the new CIA director after the abrupt resignation of Porter Goss. Hayden, who served as the director of the NSA from 1999 to 2005, is now under scrutiny for his role in initiating these covert data collection programs. In a related development, ABC News reported that the FBI acknowledged that it was seeking journalists' phone records as part of an investigation into government leaks to news organizations on secret U.S. prisons and warrantless wiretapping. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Christopher Pyle, a former intelligence officer who worked with congressional committees to reveal Pentagon spying on civilian politics during the Nixon era. Pyle, who now teaches constitutional law at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, examines the legality of the NSA surveillance programs and the threat President Bush's actions pose to American democracy.
This latest disclosure reports that the government has collected files on tens of millions of American citizens. The wiretapping that was disclosed in December is said, according to the president's characterization, to focus only on international phone calls by al-Qaeda to people in the United States. I think that is not true. I believe that what really got disclosed, and which they still will not acknowledge, is a massive data mining operation that was not focused on anybody in particular. And that's why they couldn't get a judicial warrant for it and had to ignore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. In order to get authority for a wiretap from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, they would have to establish probable cause to believe that the target of the surveillance was an agent of a foreign power, including a terrorist organization. If you're conducting data mining, which is ransacking searches of large volumes of information about all sorts of people, then, of course, you could never get a warrant. You couldn't establish probable cause. And that's why they did it without warrants. Now, that is a crime. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act clearly states that its procedures are the exclusive procedures by which national security wiretaps can be conducted. And to violate that law is to commit a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. So the president and the director of NSA have admitted to committing a felony.
What about the notion of trusting our executive branch without oversight from Congress, without oversight from the courts? Is that not a recipe for problems?
Well, the president said that we don't wiretap without a court order, but of course he did, and did so massively. He said that we don't torture prisoners, but his administration did, massively. When the NSA wiretapping was revealed, he claimed that it focused on just a few international telephone calls. And we know now that it was really a program of indiscriminate data mining, not targeted intercepts. And we also know now that NSA is tapping into the phone records of tens of millions of people. And the president won't answer these questions, and he plans to have these questions stonewalled. In addition, both the attorney general and the vice president believe the president has the power, anytime he wishes, to secretly wiretap anyone, including all domestic calls, even in direct violation of the criminal laws that forbid it. Now, I would ask the question, can you trust such an administration?
Professor Pyle, I wanted to ask you a bit about Air Force General Michael Hayden, who was the director of the National Security Agency from 1999 to 2005. It was under his purview that these NSA surveillance programs began. He, of course, is now up to replace Porter Goss as CIA director. There will be confirmation hearings in the Senate. Is he qualified with this record to be the next CIA director, in your view?
Well, I think he's one of the most experienced intelligence officers we have. And I have no objection to the fact that he happens to be a general. The CIA has been headed by generals in the past, It has always been a mix of civilian and military personnel, and that's probably needed to coordinate the work of multiple intelligence agencies. But it does seem to me that a person who has committed a felony is not qualified to serve as the head of a department of government.
What should be done? If you were advising a congressperson or a senator, what would you advise them to do in terms of trying to get some accountability for what's going on here with what clearly looks like it's a constitutional crisis?
It is a constitutional crisis. It's the most severe crisis in American history. And I don't see that advising anybody in Congress at the moment is going to do a great deal because they are behaving like party politicians. But if one of the houses were to be taken over by the opposition party in the fall, then we could have hearings, then we could have subpoenas issued for information, then we could get to the bottom of this. And it's nothing like a good ray of sunshine to send these roaches scurrying back to the woodwork, clearing the decks for a constitutional government once more. But we do need to set a spotlight into this situation. And that will require probably a change in the control of at least one House of Congress. And it's not that the Democrats are better on civil liberties than the Republicans. I think we'd have something very similar if the Democrats had been in power in both the White House and the Congress. I'm not saying this in a partisan in any way. The Democrats have no great track record in civil liberties. But we need an opposition party in Congress in order to make the system of checks and balances work. We have developed two constitutions in the United States. The one you and I studied in school, the open constitution, the constitution of the framers. And the other one is the unwritten constitution of the secret government. And it seems to me we're in a contest now to see which constitution is going to control us. The secret one, invented in secret by politicians and intelligence agencies, or the one written by the framers to govern us all in times of peace and war. And I hope that the written constitution survives. But at the moment, the president is claiming the power to ignore the constitution, to ignore acts of Congress, to ignore the courts, and to do anything he pleases if he claims that it somehow will protect us against terrorists. Well, that's not what the framers intended. That's not what the law provides. That is a recipe for a monarchy or worse.
That was Christopher Pyle, a former intelligence officer who worked with Congress to establish the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He now teaches constitutional law at Mount Holyoke College. As violence continues to consume Iraq, more American, Iraqi soldiers, and civilians are being killed daily in attacks and suicide bombings. With the war going badly, several prominent retired generals publicly called for the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. But President Bush has rebuffed his critics and growing public opposition to the war by coming out in full support of Rumsfeld and the course of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. The White House plan to gradually hand over the security of Iraq to the new U.S.-trained Iraqi army suffered setbacks in recent incidents. During a graduation ceremony of nearly 1,000 new Iraqi soldiers in early May, dozens of the troops stripped off their uniforms as they declared that they would refuse to serve outside their home areas. Another incident on May 13th involved an armed confrontation between Kurdish and Shiite units of the Iraqi army, resulting in the shooting death of at least one Shiite soldier. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stan Goff, retired Special Forces Master Sergeant, author, and peace activist. Goff, who served in the U.S. Army from 1970 to 1996 and saw combat in eight nations, explains why he believes the U.S. has already lost the Iraq War.
There was a time a couple years ago when people, you know, still sort of hadn't been convinced yet that U.S. military invincibility was a myth. I mean, even people who opposed the war, you know, still thought that we were all Cassandras and whatnot when we said the U.S. is going to lose this war. I think I said that as early as June of 2003. A conventional military force in an occupier role cannot win a war like this. In fact, there's not a single case in history where it's ever been done without a war of extermination. This is not possible given the geopolitical situation right now. The desertion rates inside the Iraqi armed forces are astronomical. As you say, there are fratricidal incidents that are breaking out among the various factions, and we're seeing actually a tactical rapprochement at the highest levels between members of the Kurdish semi-autonomous organizations in the north and some of the Sunni guerrilla organizations as a counterweight to the Iran-leaning semi-puppet government, I guess, of the United Iraqi Alliance, which is, you know, basically biding its time to see if it can consolidate its power under the given circumstances. There's really no solution to this that involves the continuation of the American military operation. And the only way this is going to get resolved is for it to get resolved locally. The presence of military occupation troops over there right now is the single most significant catalyst for creating the internecine violence that exists in Iraq right now, because the relations between the various formations, the various sectors within Iraqi society right now are all being distorted by the presence of that occupying force. There's no justification left for remaining in Iraq, and so you hear these really remarkable notions, even coming from the Democratic Party, that we can't leave now, and when in fact that would be absolutely the best thing we could do. The sooner the better. This is not wine. It's not going to get better with age. Yeah, it's time to go.
Well, what about the protestations of many in Congress who say if you, quote, cut and run now, you'll accomplish two horrendous things. You'll unleash the forces of an all-out civil war in Iraq where many more people will die. And they also say U.S. credibility in the world will go down a whole bunch of notches.
Yeah, well, you know, the last time I heard that was around 1970. That's what they were saying about Vietnam. In fact, that was exactly what they were saying about Vietnam. And so they stayed the course, end quote, until they were pulling the last of their occupation diplomats off the roof of the U.S. Embassy in UH-1 November helicopters. So, and that's where this will end, ultimately. The Iraqis have already made up their mind that they're not going to tolerate a foreign military occupation. And that should be apparent to anybody that's paying attention right now. Civil wars, it looks to me like there's one going on already. And again, the motivation for that civil war is to contest for power with those who have allied themselves with the occupation force. The Iraqis are perfectly capable of figuring out where their best interests lie. But what they have to remove from the equation right now is this malevolent occupation. And it is a malevolent occupation. It's a racist occupation. It's an extremely brutal occupation. And it's an occupation that's there for the purpose of domination. There's never been any notion of exporting democracy unless it could be somehow controlled in its actual execution by the government of the United States. The purpose of this invasion was to establish permanent military bases there and nothing else. Everything else has been secondary to that. People should learn by and by, if they, again, just pay a little attention, that pronouncements from our government are never designed to represent reality. Official pronouncements are designed to gain your consent for policies. And so whether or not those pronouncements have any element of truth is purely incidental. You know, the things that they tell us are going on over there are designed to get us to continue to sign the checks for the war. But if you look at what they're doing as opposed to what they're saying, you can see that they're building these massive city-sized, you know, permanent military installations over there. So it's very apparent what the purpose is for the U.S. to be over there. And it's also apparent, if anyone really knows something about, you know, in any detail and concretely what's going on the ground in Iraq, that the Iraqis are no more interested in a civil war than anyone else. In fact, they have a very direct interest in avoiding a civil war. It's the presence of the occupation itself that's provoking that situation right now.
That was Stan Goff, retired Special Forces Master Sergeant and peace activist. He is the author of three books, including Full Spectrum Disorder. Read his articles online at www.stangoff.com. To commemorate Mother's Day, Save the Children released its State of the World's Mothers 2006 report, focusing on the 60 million women who give birth every year with no professional medical help. 2 million infant deaths occur in their first 24 hours of life, and 4 million die in their first month. 75% of these deaths are preventable by taking steps such as vaccinating pregnant women against tetanus, providing antibiotics for infection, and knit caps to keep newborns warm. Save the Children ranked the status of mothers and children in 125 countries based on 10 indicators pertaining to health and education. Scandinavian countries placed in the top three best places to be a mother, while countries in sub-Saharan Africa comprised the worst nations for mothers and children. The United States ties for 10th place with the United Kingdom. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mary Beth Powers, the reproductive health advisor to Save the Children. She travels the world, counseling the group's staff and their local partners on ways to improve birth outcomes. She describes both grassroots efforts and the need for increased government and private funding, focusing on the critical first month of life.
Well, I think the good news is that we've been able to globally reduce deaths to children under five, but the sad news is that we've done practically nothing to reduce newborn mortality, so those 4 million kids who die in the first month of life.
Do you think the infant mortality has risen absolutely, or that just reports like Save the Children's are doing a better job of documenting it?
I think documentation of child mortality and women's mortality, for that matter, is improving around the world. So we have a much better picture of the problem and what is really killing these kids. But in addition, once we reduce the deaths due to measles and some of these other things that affect children who are older than 1 year, more and more of the death is concentrated in that first year and that first month of life, and very little progress has been made in that window, especially that first month. So that's what we're really trying to highlight. The Gates Foundation has given us a grant to work on this issue of saving newborn lives, but we really know that even Bill Gates' money alone is not enough. We really need the U.S. government and citizens to get involved in trying to help save these kids.
What are some of the main causes of infant mortality that you found in the report?
Birth asphyxia, when kids can't breathe, probably because of birth trauma. Remember, many of these girls are very young when they get married and start childbearing. Those are one of the leading causes of newborn mortality. Secondly, infection. These kids get infections because 60 million women are delivering at home, often alone or with a relative. So there are all sorts of, you know, ways they could get infected through the birth process or after birth based on how they cut the cord. And infection is one of the leading killers of these kids. And with simple antibiotics, we could treat those infections, but you have to know the child is sick and have the antibiotics there to treat the child. So those are two of the leading reasons that newborns die.
I was in Haiti last year with a woman who works in a project to reduce infant mortality. They put together a kit that includes some very basic items, including a new razor blade to cut the umbilical cord of the babies.
That's almost the most critical piece you can have, is a clean blade to cut the cord. But in a lot of cultures, there's behavior of putting something on that cord. Sometimes it's ashes, sometimes it's cow dung. And, of course, dung is full of spores that could cause tetanus. So it's really almost the most dangerous thing we could be putting on that cord, but people do it.
Mary Beth Powers, your report recommends caps for newborns as a way to reduce mortality. And I know that babies in the U.S. get those little muslin caps when they're born, when they're in the hospital. Why is that so important?
Especially for a newborn baby, but any baby, their head surface is such a large portion of their whole body surface that they lose, you know, most of the heat out of their body, they lose out of their head. So actually covering the head is an important intervention, because hypothermia can leave kids more likely to get an infection, as well as it causes them to burn calories to try and keep warm, and a lot of these kids are low birth weight. After the report came out and some of the news stories about these simple interventions, women from all over America have been calling Save the Children, asking if they could knit for newborns, and they're going to be sending these caps to Save the Children so that we can take them first to Washington to demonstrate how much American citizens care about all these newborn deaths around the world, to educate Congress and the President about the fact that we need more money for maternal newborn health programs.
Right after news of your report came out, I read that Senator Chris Dodd has introduced a bill to double the amount of foreign aid that goes to improve maternal and child health, which now stands at $356 million. Is that something that Save the Children is tracking?
Yes, we've actually helped draft that legislation with teams of people on the Hill. And the good news is that it's bipartisan. There was also a Republican co-sponsor, Senator Smith from Oregon. So Senator Dodd and Senator Smith have introduced it on the Senate side, and it's already been introduced in the House. But, you know, the important thing is the decision to appropriate money comes out of another committee. So we're really looking for Congress people to support this concept of doubling and doubling again to eventually $1.2 billion, the amount of funding that the United States puts into these maternal child health programs globally. And that would be the equivalent if every American family of four would just forego two pizzas a year. We could raise the $1.2 billion that way. But we really think that the U.S. government could do more to save these kids' lives overseas.
Congress just passed an extension of tax cuts that mostly go to the wealthiest Americans and amounts to $70 billion. How much harder do you think that will make it to increase this foreign aid?
How the U.S. government decides to spend their money is a complicated process I couldn't completely explain. But I do think that because Americans care about this issue, because grandmothers from Columbus to Santa Barbara have already called Save the Children saying, I will knit a hat, my friends will knit a hat, and we'd be happy for you to take them to Washington to demonstrate to the U.S. government that this is a priority, that we are giving them permission to spend our tax dollars on saving newborn lives, is I think, the message that we want to give in Washington. Anyone who's lost a child or has a friend or a relative who lost a child knows how heartbreaking that is as a parent. So it just seems like absolutely something that ought to be central to our international foreign assistance budget.
That was Mary Beth Powers of Save the Children. Call the group at area code 203-221-4000 or visit their website at www.savethechildren.org. There you can read the full report and also find information on the Knit for Newborns project. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be featuring an interview with Robert Glennon, author of Water Follies, The Impact of Groundwater Pumping on the Environment. We'll also bring you an update from Save Our Groundwater on the Nottingham water pumping case, and a talk by Carlo Petrini, founder of the Slow Food Movement, given at UNH on May 18th. We leave you with this quote by Eli Wiesel. take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented.